Welcome to Dream Path. Deja Nu, coming through with solutions. Our guests, Dorinka Blagaj and Dwayne.
Every time I look at you, I get the feeling that I've been here once before. Then you watch it go. Can you remember times we were all together? Laughter in the arms. Deja vu coming true.
Good evening. Hello there.
It's Dwayne calling.
Hi, Dwayne.
How are you?
Well, we're in the mood.
We could just go and ramble on, and if we just want to keep it to sort of the subject of Anastasia's story.
You know, Dwayne, I didn't need to know a whole lot to be very intrigued by what you would like to bring forth in terms of that energy.
Well, that is possible because I'm in the process, as I continue to study this subject through Vladimir and Anastasia's story, of trying to find the Canadian equivalent to it,
ah,
a Canadian application to essentially the Motherland Party.
Yeah.
Where we actually grant everybody who's willing and who really wants to work, everybody gets a free hectare of land. And there's a party in Quebec, that, or I should say in Russia, where they're trying to actually do this right now, where anybody who wants can have one free hectare of land that they call their kindred domain, and they're not taxed for the property, and they're not taxed for what they produce on the property.
Beautiful.
And it hasn't quite got to complete fruition on that subject yet in Russia, but there's enough kind of, the equivalent would be like the hippies / yuppies here who have moved out to the country now, and they're growing their own food, and they're creating organic produce, and their farmers markets are popping up all over the place. Well, in Russia, there's, I don't remember the name of the type of people that they are or what the Russian word for it is, but they have completely caused total havoc in the country against the industrial food producers. The industrial food producers in Russia can't sell a potato today. Can't sell anything because everybody there knows what the food's made of and wants good food.
Yeah.
And then when you really start to get your own domain and you learn, one of the suggestions that I tried last year was when you're growing your own food, Anastasia suggests that you walk through your own garden in your bare feet. That's the toxins in your own body mix with your soil.
Yeah.
While you're preparing your soil for the seeds, you hold the seeds in your mouth for at least 9 minutes. And then you take these seeds and you put them into the soil and maybe even spit a little bit into each one of the seeds and then don't water it for 3 days. Those seeds will actually identify with the DNA in your saliva and will produce a vegetable for you, particularly.
That sounds perfect.
Yeah.
It does. Right now, at this time, it's not even a concept anymore. As you're pointing out, it's happening. It's going on. And what could be the equivalent?
It's beyond the concept now, because these books actually came out in Russia in 1995.
Yeah. Okay.
They've only recently come out in English in February 2005 by a Canadian Russian literature professor from the University of Ottawa, who sort of was asked to translate for them. And I was under the impression from reading the books that he was quite skeptical of her. No. It sort of reads a little bit like a fairy tale.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people have a difficult time sort of really accepting that it's true because it seems too fantastic. But the information is so practical that you sit there and you think, you know, on the first page of the first book, it's written across the top of the page, "I exist for those whom I exist." And you don't have to believe me. Just read the book. And she uses word combinations that he's copied from her that she believes will unlock our memory, our DNA memory. Mm-hmm. And this is all about, her most ambitious process or program here is to remind us of the pristine origin from whence we fell, from our Vedic past.
You mentioned earlier about Anastasia, about keywords or
word
just reading it, word combinations, because I just heard a few. I heard some. That's all I needed to hear. I felt the magic of it.
Yeah.
I really did. And something in me knew, so that anything I'm hearing about it, I'm just going, yeah.
this story is quite phenomenal. And I'm actually coming from a really serious conspiratorial background.
Right.
Over the last 25 years.
Huh?
But it was about 3 or 4 books into the series, because I've been right on them ever since. I learned about this about 3 years before it even came into English. And how when two people actually meet each other and fall in love, they walk around the neighborhood and the village and they kind of point at all the things in the neighborhood that they really like and what kind of pigs they like. And no pigs.
Huh.
They're totally vegetarian. They're not even vegetarian. They're beyond that. They just eat what's live in front of them when they feel like they might. Like when a strawberry bush suggests that they should have a piece of strawberry right
now. Yeah,
I mean, this is, it's so intuitive, this lifestyle, to the point where you know, though, my point is, I like what you've done with this part of your house and here and that and this kind of tree you have and this bush. And Anastasia suggests that on your hectare, you should grow no less than 300 different fruit and herb, fruit trees and herbs. And the combination of all of this, in book 7, she talks about, and this is what got the high priest all concerned on the planet, because she knew something that they took off the walls of their temple 10,000 years ago, which was the statement, eat as you would breathe. And in that time, when we had so much life as trees and fruit trees and herbs and all these things in our yards, and everybody had yards like that, there was so much pollen floating around that you could eat as you would breathe.
Nectar of the gods.
I'm very intrigued with the energy that you say is created in the books, and in fact that this energy exists and can be tapped into. Duane also mentioned to myself before we spoke to him last night, he's actually getting training from her, that he feels he's connecting with her in the dream time.
Yep.
And receiving knowledge and wisdom from, I suppose, this energy field that you're referring to.
Yeah, it's pretty strong because it's very loving. Like, it's got it's also the femininity of it, you know. It is definitely a goddess frequency. It's quite different than, it's an empowered goddess frequency. Because I've painted goddesses for so much of my life, for, you know, 20 years, there definitely is a frequency that comes across that is different than talking about God as a he. I know people know that God is not a he or a she, but just the relationship of saying that, you know, he, every time you refer to God, you're making like an energetic differentiation. And with the Anastasia books, the energy that comes across is very different, because you have Vladimir, who's the so-called writer of the book, but he's also quoting her, Anastasia, talking, and when she talks, there is this fluid, clear, beautiful frequency, and you can feel it. When she talks, there is a resonance to everything that she says. It's like you just nod your head. You're reading the book, and you're nodding your head saying, yeah. Wow. Oh, you know, it's very fun. So the part that I was talking about, where she is accessible outside of the book. So once you've tapped into this frequency, it's in her name. It's in all of our names. All of our names have a frequency. And if you say your name, that's like the way to unlock your frequency. So if someone really wants to speak to someone else, and they want to speak to that person's higher self or their godness or their goddessness or whatever, the name is a part of it. So her name, the way it's pronounced in the books, is, I believe it's Anastasia. And that part of it is, you can definitely connect to her. Even if you say Anastasia and you've got your English pronunciation, you still connect to her energy. It is like a God flow energy, but it is definitely of somebody. I don't even know if she is embodied, if she is an actual physical being, or if she is really just a channel that's creating this possible way of looking at things, a new interpretation of humanity and human life. I haven't come to a conclusion as to whether she's physically real and being living right now on the planet. That's not clear to me. But what is clear to me is that her energy field is completely something you can tap into. It's very beautiful. She does talk about a lot of things that are meaningful to me. One of them is the space of love. So every being has around them a space of love. That space of love can be cultivated. You can put your inner attention to wonderful things that have happened in your life. You can bring them back into your consciousness at any moment and allow yourself to feel the resonance of that energy, and that energy coats you and helps you sail through times that maybe aren't as, they don't feel as loving. So there's this, when you get into this thought that you can actually give yourself a space of love all the time, then that compression that we experience in our Western society of things hitting us in the face, not a break, constant stress, a constant need to interpret information, digest it, react to it, and move on to something new, that whole thing kind of starts to be pushed aside. It's not as important. When you concentrate on giving yourself a space of love around you, it's very different. And when it comes to children, the book talks about co-creation, well, the series talks about co-creation, and when two people want to co-create a child, and they put their focus on how incredible this being is going to be that they will be making together, that child then has a space of love around them. And when that child is nurtured further in the mother's womb, when the mother's thinking about all the glory that's going to come to this child and all the amazing beauty of life and nature and everything that this child will participate in, that furthers that idea of a space of love. And then when the mother's breastfeeding, by putting the attention on the child and on the love, just the pure love that the mother and baby feel, and the mother also feeling this love extending into the future of the child, that gives the child this incredible sense of well-being, comfort, and again, this cushion around them of this space of love. And I've had this experience with my own children where I did very consciously conceive my son with my husband, and his whole journey was quite incredible. And our journey with him, now that he's 10 years old, continues to be incredible. And he is a very loving and passionate person. And to consider children as full gods and goddesses when they come onto the planet, just as we are, is as important as the space of love. Because when you consider that a child is someone lesser than you as an adult, you've just dumbed them down. The instant you think of them like that, you dumb them down. The moment you consider that this being is like you, you know, of this friend. And in the Anastasia books, just to get back to that, this whole concept of thinking, allowing yourself to think cognizantly, understand the world through experience of it, direct experience, not somebody's criticism of it or someone's critique of the world, and they go, oh yeah, don't go outside, it's too cold, oh, don't go outside, it's too many bugs, or oh, don't sit in that, that's like a, that's a bog, you don't want to get your pants muddy, you know. So that all takes away the experience of the individual, right? So these books are aimed at recontextualizing one's own experience and one's own thought process, and accelerating thought to the point where you're opening up more parts of your brain, because that's what naturally happens when you accelerate your thought.
Yes. And so here was, I've gone in 2, 3, 4 different directions, and I forgot
well,
where
you know,
I started
this
from.
Is when the translation started, you know, when you were talking with, or she was reading to you in German or and doing the translation. What stirred in you at that time? I mean, it started stirring.
I just thought it was a neat idea.
Yeah.
I just thought it was a terrific idea, and it was, because we were also living in Creemore at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And I was living in that nature.
Yeah, yeah.
We had 85 acres up on a hill with 25 acres of hardwood forest in the back with ponds, and I was busy cutting. I kept, every week, I kept 5 kilometers of trails cut for walking around throughout our backyard, and I was actually interacting with deer and birds and just all the wildlife, you know. But it all comes from a place where I've come from for many years of studying metaphysics also. I met a tribe years ago who visited Toronto called the Kogi. The Kogi are a tribe from the highlands of Colombia. They never came down off the mountain because, as far as they were concerned, they understood that there was nobody asleep who could ever receive their message off the hill. Then about 15 years ago, they got this message that there was somebody off the hill who could hear them. And their belief was if they could sell their message to one person, it was enough to come off the hill to share that with that one person, to save that one person. Hmm. And that one person, or I'm not sure exactly who they thought it was, but it turned out to be a guy I know named Drunvalo Melchizedek.
Oh, really?
Drunvalo, yes.
You know Drunvalo?
Yes.
So I've worked with the Flower of Life Understanding for a long time.
Right.
And Merkabas. And so it was just, they were the ones then who, when they came to Toronto, and we met them all at the Royal Ontario Museum, where they gave a talk, they introduced us, plus and other stuff that Drunvalo released about the heart brain. Are you familiar with the heart brain story?
Not with the story, no.
Well, physiologically speaking, the heart develops in the fetus before the brain does. So there's actually in our hearts this little gray matter. And I've never met a heart specialist or someone that I can get a straight answer from about this, but the story that Drunvalo told was that if a heart specialist doing a heart operation on a patient, if his scalpel were to touch this gray matter, patient dies, no recovery. Then the Kogi come and they tell this story about how we can access that heart brain and thus communicate from our heart, which a lot of, you know, the old Hindus and a lot of the old Vedic texts talk about our hearts and our brains, right? I mean, you know, it's sort of, most people just sort of look at the heart as a muscle that's pumping blood, but in the old metaphysics, they taught that we actually communicate from our heart. But now we actually have physical evidence that there's a little brain in there that's conscious. And then the Kogi come along and share with us a meditation technique of easily for women, a little bit more complicated for men, to access this spot.
Right.
And then communicate from that spot.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the Kogi said to us was, you know you're in your heart brain when you can communicate and talk with small animals and they don't run away from you. And so through Drunvalo and the Earth Sky Workshop up in Collingwood, we all did these really great exercises to learn how to access or quickly access to visualize what your heart brain even looks like and how to go there whenever you want. And then shortly thereafter in Boulder, and there was this 5 wild deer just walked up in the back of the property. And so I said, well, let's go out and meet them. And before we left, we sort of stood in a triangular circle and we sort of held hands and we kind of consciously went into our heart brains. And then we walked out and the deer quickly poked her head up and looked at us. And I don't know what the others said, but I said within myself, don't worry about anything. We're not here to eat you. We just want to come out and say hi, and everything's cool. And they immediately went back to just eating grass and being calm. Mm-hmm. And I actually had a pocket full of carrots. Actually, and these were all, there were 2 females and 3 males. And the males, 2 of them had 4 points and 1 had 5 points.
Right.
Guys, yeah.
Big antlers. And I'm sitting there, and I walk up to this 5-point buck, and he just looks at me. And I held a carrot out to him, and he walks over to me, probably 3 to 5 feet, walks over to me. And they stayed for a year after we left, I might add. But here I am, holding a carrot. And I've fed lots of horses with carrots, and, you know, you put it in their teeth, and you sort of crack it over and break it for them. And I did this for 1 carrot, 2 carrots. And then I thought, well, let's try something else. Instead of breaking the carrot, I'll make the deer break it off, right? Make him work for it a little bit. And at one point, he couldn't, so we were playing tug-of-war with a carrot. And there's a photograph somewhere of me with this these antlers that are wrapped, like they're around my shoulders, while this guy is like pulling backwards, tugging on this carrot with me. Right? It was really, really entertaining. And so that was my first experience about getting confirmation that, you know, maybe this heartburn's a real thing.
Yeah.
And then the second time I actually really believed I confirmed it, I was back here. We were living in Richmond Hill at the time. And I went out to my garden in the back, and all my lettuce was 2 inches was straight across. All my lettuce was cleaned off, 2 inches long or something. So I walked out to the back, and here was this little bunny in my one of my raised beds. And the bunny looked at me. He was about to take off when I said, "Oh, it's okay. I'm not here to eat you. We just have to have a conversation." And I sat down, and this rabbit sat 8 feet away from me at the other end of the box and looked at me. And I looked at the bunny, and I said, "I don't mind that you share some of our garden with you, with us, but there's more than just you here." So I kind of made a motion. I said, "Here, from here," I gave the rabbit about 2 feet of the end of the box. I said, "You can have whatever's at the end here, but leave the rest for us." And for the next month or so, the rabbit obeyed that.
Wow.
And now, and then years later, I've come across these books, and one of the things that Anastasia says over and over again, she says, plants and animals go into instant ecstasy if you will just assign them a responsibility.
Oh. Yeah.
Are you in ecstasy yet, my fellow gopher? Go for what? Go for this? Go for that? Go for your ecstasy by being in service to others. That is the new commandment that I have been given.
Okay, Doug, help me with that beer. Just pass it through the passage here, okay?
Hey, what are you doing, Hoser? Hey, I like your shirt. Is that my shirt?
Yeah, well, you know, I knew it was going to be, like, cold, so I needed to have a warm shirt.
Yeah. Looks just like my plaid shirt.
Where's my toque? Anyway, right down this way, look, there's a door, and I went up to it, and it was, like, really creepy. But I figured, like, this is a good place to put our beer. Look at it.
Wow.
It's amazing.
But
I feel good. Let's go.
Who's that?
Hey, I thought that was you.
That's not
it's really
bad.
Close by.
I'm freaking me out with this.
There's never anyone here before when I came. Well, actually, there was. That's why I brought you along.
Where's this door you're talking about, man?
Right over here. Look, you just grab the handles here. And you
what does it say on the top there?
It says Dortmund. Dortmund. I'm sure. It looks like a casket, you know? I mean, like the beer cap. Whoa.
Oh. Hey, uh-oh.
Here's, what's that? I never heard that before.
Igor.
Holy God.
Welcome. I am the gatekeeper of Dortmund.
Yeah, well, I'm Bob, and this is Doug. You're Dortmund?
Dortmund.
Yeah, okay, Dortmund.
Before you can pass, you must answer three questions. What is your name?
Well, Doug, you're a hoser, right?
Yeah, we're both hosers, man.
What is your quest?
I think it's kind of obvious.
How many fingers does a female meerkat have?
Hey, hoser, less than me, I bet.
All right. You answer the questions and now I'll pass.
Oh, good. Thanks.
I will open the door.
Whoa. Hey, this is new Doug. I haven't seen this before. Whoa. Look at that. Hey. Oh, I think all those beers I had before we came in here really got to my head, you know.
You're going to get Igor all upset, you know.
Here's Dortmund again.
Here, the dungeon of Dortmunde. Here lies all knowledge known to man, a vast library of the greatest minds of men and not men, written in leather-bound books.
Yeah.
In Corinthian leather, eh?
Yeah.
There are at least 2,500 books of knowledge.
Here's one. The Grand Master of Pithecus.
Hey, I had the Pithecus because I drank too much beer, eh?
Pithecus. Here's another one. Horatio comes to the golden goose. Yeah, well, it's sort of like a fairy tale, I think, eh?
Go. Choose a book and sit at the table. You must relax.
Hey, this one looks good. The Maiden Goddesses of Crete.
Hey, pictures. Look.
Yeah, okay.
Wow.
Let's get on that one, man.
We got to take this with us. Look, we'll leave the beer here. We'll take the books. We'll have to wait till Lurch goes out, okay?
Okay. Yeah, yeah, there he goes.
Oh, yeah.
See you, Lurch.
See you, Lurch. Thanks a lot,
Igor.
Hey, do you know how to find our way out of here again?
Did you
leave the breadcrumbs or is it like Hansel and Gretel?
Well, we left some beer bottles along the way.
Oh, yeah.
Remember? You drank all those things.
Yeah, that's right. I left the bottle caps. Okay, good.
And then you pithecused in the beer bottles and left them there. You hoser.
They're here, and that's part of what the old books would say. You know, like somebody has sort of rewritten the Bible a bit to say we have dominion over the animals, which people like my grandmother are religious people. They say, well, that means that we have control over everybody. We can slaughter them, do whatever we want with them. Mm. But it's an actual harmonious, symbiotic relationship where we're not supposed to eat them. We're just supposed to be with them and let them help us or do whatever. Like in Anastasia's story, the squirrels go just insane if she can say, like, why don't you pick me some pine nuts? And they run around and they pull these pine cones apart and they pull all the skin off and they make little piles of pine nuts on leaves for her. That's where some people say, you know, it's a little bit of a distance for them to stretch that you can actually have a relationship with wild animals like that, but why not, is what I say. You know, I just kind of think it seems like a heck of a nicer place to live than this lifetime.
Well, you know, the energy of what you're talking about, the communication from the heart and the communication that naturally happens with animals at that level is, I mean, they go into ecstasy, so do you.
So do you, yeah.
And what a wonderful feeling that is. And I think that's something that really we all truly desire. Bringing through something at this time, it's like the...
Oh, the Kogi?
Kogi? Like the Kogi coming down from the mountain. I think there's more of that coming down from the mountain, coming up from the valley, and there's reception to that now.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gurdjieff said, when you communicate from your heart, you affect the hearts of others. When you communicate from your brain, you can only affect another's brain.
Yeah, yeah.
And that inspired me to attempt to communicate to anybody from my heart, subverting their intellect. Mm. Like if I really have a serious message I have to get through to somebody, I first try to make an attempt to get into my own heart first and then communicate with real honor and truth from a place that's loving. And it's funny to watch people. It's almost, you know, sometimes I've boasted that it's a manipulative tool also, because in fact, when you give somebody, I believe the single greatest weakness of a human being is the truth, especially a heartfelt truth. Because they will lose sleep at night with their ego and their analytical abilities to try to break down that truth that you just shared with them. But the truth is the truth. And when it's delivered in such a way that it's love and it's non-judgmental and it's just honorable, it creates havoc. You know, I just think that it makes me laugh just like you guys are laughing. It's so much fun.
I just had a thought here because Dwayne brought up the fact of the brain and the heart and how we can think from the heart.
The heart brain.
The heart brain. And what you're talking about, it is very much like that. I don't know if you think about it that way.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, the connection of opening the heart and thinking, it's an experience connection. Like, if you think about it, in your own life, when you have an experience that's deep to you, it's not like your head is buzzing, right? It is your heart. It's your center. Your entire center is light, is feeling excited, is illuminated, and it's not just passion, it's more than passion. It's like an ecstatic feeling of, I've had moments of ecstatic feelings, and it's such a deep resonance that all it wants to do is share itself. Like the joy of sharing an experience that we have that's like that, it's beyond other joys that I've experienced. Like just the joy to want to share that energy. I think it's the most natural thing to be naturally abundant with that kind of energy. But it is being bred out of us in the way that we are living and in the way that we are taught to live and the way that we are taught to think and not think and in the way we are taught to love and not love and in the double talk of our society. You know, kids in school and kindergarten learn to share. You know, Suzuki's daughter made a speech to the UN when she was, what, 9 years old?
Yeah.
And she got up and she said, in kindergarten, you teach us to share. You teach us it's wrong to fight. You teach us. And she went on and on and on and made all these points that we do indeed teach our kindergarten students. We have art, we play, blah, blah, blah. And look what you guys do, you adults. You fight, you cheat, you steal, you lie. And for what? And, you know, her speech is brilliant. Like, if you ever have a chance to hear it, I don't know her first name, but it's David Suzuki's daughter, and she's now in her, I think she's now in her 20s, early 20s. And it was amazing to someone so young, so succinctly just put it out there and said, hello, I'm watching, what's going on here? And so back to the energy of the Anastasia, I have tapped into her energy. It came early in my reading the books. I wanted to know if she existed. I wanted to know how, if it was possible to access this energy field of this goddess, and it is definitely easy to access. You can feel a warmth around you when you access it. It's like accessing, it's accessing a master field of energy. The thing that I like about it is that she doesn't divide herself from and says, I'm so-and-so incredible and you are, you know, whatever. She really has this sense of us, all of us now. All of us now can shift and move to this frequency together. And whether she's holding that field and that's what her job is, or whether she's just pointing people to that field that exists all around us but is not being used and tapped into, it almost doesn't matter, you know. I have noticed that I was very excited, very passionate. I read the books really quickly. I went back and reread sections. There's a lot of tediousness in Vladimir's writing and his own thought processes, which sometimes I thought, oh my God, if I have to read any more of this guy's own thought process, I'm going to puke. But whenever you read the parts when he quotes her, it's just so rich and full that you can really flip through your other pages quickly. And it verifies that aspect that we can all tune into something that is right in front of us and right inside us, and we can all make a difference with it. At every moment, we can make a difference to, she says, two people is better than no people. You know, one person is better than nobody thinking about this. So it doesn't take a huge amount of people to come together and change how things are working in the world. It'll just take people of like heart and mind who will know each other because of the way they choose to act and the way they choose to respect and the way they choose to love and be on the planet and where they put their attention on a daily level, you know.
Anastasia, she is someone I understand to be immortal.
I don't know if she's an immortal. She's aging. She's about 33 years old today.
Oh, really? Okay.
Her great-grandfather just died and passed down all of his wisdom into her son, or her and Vladimir's son. Vlad's the man who wrote the books. Vlad got onto this whole subject because he was a boat captain going up and down the Ob River sort of during perestroika and being an entrepreneur, delivering any products that anybody wanted upriver. And he meets these two old men who tell him about the ringing cedars of Russia and these pine nuts, and he does some research about these pine nuts and finds that the oil from these pine nuts is more valuable than gasoline and oil. And he uncovers that there's this massive underground trade going on for this product that nobody seems to know anything about, but it's all leaving Siberia and going out to the other side of the world. And a lot of it's being processed through China at that time. And so he, greed really gets the better of him, and he goes back to this place looking for these two old men, and he bumps into her, Anastasia.
Oh.
And she says, oh, yeah, I know those two guys. One is my grandfather, and the other's his father. And the grandfather's 117 years old. So it's just... It's not that they're immortals, but they...
Right.
It's sort of like Rasputin.
Yeah.
I mean, they had to overkill him to kill him. And his primary diet was these pine nuts. So they say in the book.
Oh, okay.
But it's just... I think when you live a clean, pure life, and I mean even...
He's,
physiology is showing us that our body is a self-replicating, self-healing entity. I mean, I just cut my finger really super badly last week. It's only been a week, and it's already healed now.
Another technique is to go back to 5 seconds before the injury and walk through it again without the injury.
Oh, without the injury?
Yes. Go back to the moment just before you stubbed your foot.
Yes.
And go right through the motion, go up that stair again, and when you make that step, the pain will be gone.
Right, okay. Oh, I see, so...
It's going back in time.
Go back in time and then re-see the whole issue, but don't cut my finger the second time, and
that's
then the pain
right.
goes away. I still have the wound, but I don't have any pain left.
You well, in some cases, you won't even have the wound.
Wow.
But that's... You have to master that.
I should have met you last week.
I think you're out of time when you injure yourself. You're not right in your body. So if you bring yourself back into time to the previous moment and come forward, it works.
Maybe I can still try it, and all the wounds will clean up.
Don't go out and cut the finger again.
Now, which finger was it?
My middle finger.
The middle finger.
On my left hand.
On the left hand.
Yeah.
The emotional.
Well, at this moment, I'm revitalizing every single cell in my body, and I am charging it up with this incredible wellness, and I'm going to totally relax right now while this happens. Just doing that, you know, that one thing, or I'm going to let the smile that I'm feeling, because I just feel excited about whatever, you know, I want that to permeate my entire system right now, and I want to send that energy out from me right now, and I want it to permeate as far out from me as I can send it, you know? to the universe, to whatever. The idea of being able to communicate with stars and a star as a being is really fun and interesting. Just the idea of knowing that so much information that has come through other sources to me, like information about continents that were on planet Earth that aren't here now, the kind of civilizations that were on those continents. Why do we find tablets from Egypt in places like Guatemala, which is where I found one, also in Honduras? I found a Buddha in a Honduras museum, and they had dug it up in a pyramid, a Mayan pyramid. So when you go traveling around and researching, you find out that things have moved around the planet for a long time. And our so-called history, which is all stuck in dead books, and most of it is inaccurate, according to ancient history, you know, it's all guesswork. So here in these Anastasia books, she talks about, what if you weren't guessing? What if you could... If you really want to know, or if you really need to know, something that happened in, you know, 3000 BC, what if you could just go there and take a look and know exactly what happened and ask the source? What about that as history? And those are exciting thoughts, and I like the possibilities within them. So I enjoyed that part of the series, too.
But certainly like to put our focus on those things that are making the changes, or even the changes within ourselves, that bring a vision more in tune with, you know, what, for instance, Anastasia is bringing through, or those kinds of...
My sentiments exactly, yeah. And I think, to put words in your mouth, it's a solution-based conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for so long, I've been going to all the meetings, and I've been listening to people get paid money to tell me what the problems are. And I said, yeah, I know. You guys keep on telling me what the problem is. But what's the solution?
Yeah.
Let's start having solution-based dialogue. And things like the Motherland Party, or that concept of give everybody a hectare of land. I mean, really, this is our country.
Yeah.
This is our corporation.
Yeah.
I am a shareholder of the said corporation called Canada.
Yes.
And so when these guys tell me, like, that we don't have the money,
yeah,
all I can do is say, you're either an idiot or you really honestly don't know that we're multi-millionaires, each one of us, as a birthright.
My fellow gophers, I say unto you, we have been driven from our country homes. We have been driven from our golf courses, and even driven from our underground tunnels. I say, enough is enough. 1 hectare? Ha! I want 100 hectares of land. We were here long before you. I say we take all their golf balls and sticks and take them for ransom. Hello, I'm Delia. And my partner is Chuck. We are from the gopher hierarchy. I am personally not famous, but Chuck comes from a long line of acting. His great-great-grandfather, or maybe it was his great-great-great-great-grandfather that starred with Chevy Chase in Caddyshack. Anyways, we would love to be regular guests on the Dream Path show. We can talk about gopher politics, near-death experiences, and even gopher abductions, and anything that you might consider spiritual. So, we would love to hear from you. Don't be afraid. Contact Jera. Jera is always in touch with us. And thank you. Thank you for listening.
There's no shortage of money in Canada. I've done all the numbers. I can show you.
Let's hear more about that, because it's not a train of thought. It's the truth, what you're saying there, too. And the other thing is the law.
And I'm really using hard facts.
Yeah.
One of my favorite stories that I share with people is that on September 17th, 1995, in the front page of just about every newspaper, major newspaper in Canada, is this story released by the World Bank. They spent over 5 years assessing the natural resource value of every country, dividing it by its citizens, coming up with a per capita value. And the story's headline says, Canadians are the second most valuable citizens on Earth, worth $704,000. Second place to Australia, who was valued at $849,000. And this is at a time when the U.S. dollar was, and the Canadian dollar, I mean, was $1.60. So my quick math was to show how converting from Canadian, from American to Canadian, and rounding down, every one of us was worth $1 million. And this was actually natural resources excluding water. Because at that time, they were still sort of keeping the term water. It wasn't really floating around in the world of natural resources. It was still being called a essential resource. Well, that's where I keep on pushing water back as an essential resource, not a natural resource, because the powers that be are trying to make water a natural resource, or even worse, or better for them, however you want to look at it, by licensing and selling it, they're commoditizing it.
Yeah.
And once it becomes a commodity, then it enters into the free trade agreement, not the NAFTA agreement, the free trade agreement, which we signed with America before they started talking about including Mexico.
Yeah.
The NAFTA agreement.
Yeah.
In the free trade agreement, it says that if the agreement between Canada and America is America just has to screen that they are in short supply of any natural resource or commodity recognized by the free trade agreement, and they instantly have access to 90% of that product or of that commodity at a price that they've been paying for the last 2 years, because our population is only 10% of the American population.
Right.
The free trade agreement that the premier signed was not the free trade agreement that they or their advisors read. And the free trade agreement that they signed has now been put in a time capsule for 50 years under national security. It's all about water.
Yes.
Anyways.
Take
me back to where we were before I went off on that one.
No, well, because we were talking about, you know, the balance between
the money.
Things, yeah?
So this is lacking the water. So I said, I did the math. $1.60 to Canadian dollars, round it down to $1 million. I can't ever get a really super straight answer whether there's 28 million or 32 million Canadians, so I rounded it to the middle, 30 million Canadians.
Right.
So 30 million Canadians times $1 million is $30 trillion, or $30,000 billion, $30 million. Okay?
Sounds good.
Yeah. That's just the natural resource, estimated natural resource assets of Canada, excluding water, which I would say doubles that number again.
Yeah.
So I wrote a little paragraph about this once. It's on an old computer of mine. I don't know if I can drag it out, but it's a pretty easy story to tell. But the Trudeau government committed a ghastly sin against Canadians by borrowing our own money and charging us interest to use it. By Trudeau borrowed $40 billion to pay for some social programs. But we've been operating an economy for 130 years or so before he came along and borrowed money. We never needed to borrow money. Section 91 of the Canadian Constitution gives the Prime Minister the right to create all the money he needs against the natural resource value. So why we're borrowing our money makes no sense whatsoever. Why we're borrowing money from someone else, and when, after all, it's our money in the first place that we're borrowing and paying interest on, it drive me crazy, but
essentially
we borrowed $40 billion, and since then we have compound interest, which, a little sidebar, when Einstein was asked what is the single greatest invention by humans, without hesitation he said compound interest. So, through compound interest, this $40 billion debt, this $40 billion loan, has bloomed into this current $700 billion federal debt. And that's on top of the fact that we've actually paid back about $250 billion in interest payments. So, I realized in this conversation that I've been telling over the course of about 10 years that the word billion keeps on clouding people's, it's easy to sort of fog over when you hear this economic jargon. So I rewrote the last sentence by saying, here's what it also looks like. We borrowed $40. We've paid back $250. The guy says we still owe him $700. And all the while, we have 30,000 in the bank. That's Canada's actual economic reality, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
So when these guys say, see, the catch words that nobody understands is budget and deficit and all these things. You make $100 a month. You make $100 a month. But when you come home, you just hand your wife $10 and say, make this fit in the budget. And she has to run the business or run the house off that $10 a month. And she's completely unaware of the other $90 that exists because she's only given $10 a month. If she can't make it all happen for the $10, two things can occur. Either she has to go out and get another job to cover, let's say it costs $11 for that month to run the economy.
Right.
She has to actually go out and either raise taxes, go get a job, or cut back services to stay within the $10. But she's never been told that there's actually this other $90. And what we uncovered a long time ago was this story called Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, which suggests that when taxes are collected, taxes aren't used to pay for the cost of running, you know, cops and fire departments and road workers and all that stuff. When taxes are collected, they go straight to Bay Street, and from Bay Street they go to international investment firms. And it's the dividends from these investments that gets directed towards the budgets. And so, you know, like, when even here in Toronto, I mean, this is a really super rich corporation called Toronto. And when these guys jerk off at us and say, oh, we don't have the money this year, but look, we found another $98 million. I mean, you know, they're just lying and lying. And the corruption is so thick that what I'd like to do, what I'm interested in doing, is by sharing this story about Anastasia, we can actually also introduce all this other information about our real wealth, about our real talents, about our real abilities to just manifest and create a nice lifestyle.
We have today with us a very special man, Professor Eisenkopf. Professor Eisenkopf, as many of you know...
Please,
Call me Izzy.
Oh.
For I wish to speak as one-on-one equals.
Izzy, I'm profoundly complimented by that. Thank you. Thank you so much, Izzy. Izzy, you know, you are an expert. You are a genius. You are...
No.
You are...
I've heard your interviews. You are the epitome of the interviewer. And I say this because...
Izzy.
Yes.
What solutions this world, this time...
Solutions, you say. You see, I think we all have the solutions. It is within us. You see, when I
profound,
see...
Profound.
When I see and I cough up sometimes the beauty inside that I feel when I see the world through my own eyes.
Yes.
And it's enormous sometimes. The answers that come to you and I and all people, that the solution, I think, is within us. What do you think?
Well, it is, Professor Isaacoff, if it is within
us... It is simple, is it not?
It is so...
That the solution is on the tips, on the very tips of our fingers.
Yes. You know, another thing you've always talked about, and... It always amazes me because it seems silly at times, but you often talk about fairy tales. Fairy tales and...
Fairy tales.
Yes.
The solutions of the mind wrapped around the fantasies.
The fables.
Of the fables which all have the seed.
Ah.
The solution within it. It is like a nut cracked open for you to taste, crunch, devour. This is how solutions come to you and I. We are mirrors to each other, you see. And the solution sometimes comes from seeing the face of the other and not knowing. Do you know what I mean? Not knowing.
Hey, Professor, if you could perhaps talk. You're absolutely brilliant, but please do speak into the mic.
yes. The microphone.
But it was brilliant.
That is a great solution for... You have found the way to get me... Myself. Just call me Izzy.
Izzy.
To speak at the microphone. You found, you see.
Yes.
You found the solution.
Like that.
It was on the tips of your fingers. Oh. You saw me speaking away.
Yes.
From the microphone.
Right.
You see, if I speak over here, don't really.
No,
but over here, I speak.
Yes.
And therefore, the audience
hears
can
you.
Hear me.
Yes.
It listens to what I say. You see, it's all wrapped up. It's like a tapestry, you see. Do you understand?
A tapestry.
It is like
a beautiful
tapestry. Your life starts at one end of this tapestry, and the loom goes, and you loom, and you color, and you create, and your life becomes, you see, becomes
a tapestry.
Your essence that you show to the world, you see, and the world sees you, and the reflection is shone to each other, you see. It is all inside.
It is on your fingertips.
Oh,
Izzy, Professor Isaacoff.
You're speechless.
I really am. You're truly.
But sometimes.
You truly are.
You go within the brain, and the brain. The brain responds. My God, there's so much inside of it. If we just. Excuse me, I get excited sometimes.
Here's a handkerchief, Professor.
Thank you.
You know, Professor Isaacoff has spoken to hundreds, if not thousands, if not millions of people throughout the world about solutions and how to find those solutions. And today on our show, I think we...
Please, don't forget my book,
Solutions,
by Professor Isaacoff.
Yes.
Give me some of your essence, your knowledge, your solutions, for we all have them all. Go to my site. Yes, and thank you for this interview, Dennis.
Yes.
You are, you draw, you, Dennis, you draw the essence out of your interviewees. And I am very thankful, Dennis, for this occasion and this chance to speak my essence. Thank you very much. Thank you, Izzy.
That was Professor Isaacoff, my friend Izzy. And, you know, we will take a break right now. We will have our professor back sometime, I'm sure. Thank you very much.
Take it away.
I was living in Los Angeles in 92, and there was this atrocious story that was in the newspaper about a guy who had a big orange grove. The only oranges that the orange marketing board will buy are these perfectly round oranges. But of course, the other 40 or 60% of his oranges aren't perfectly round or aren't perfectly orange. So they're not accepted. So instead of just, like in some cases, they were talking about how these guys will go and spread oranges over an entire football field and then spray poison on them to just decompose them instantly. So what this guy was doing, he was going around his neighborhood and he set up all these sort of cut-in-half garbage cans in these kind of lower-class school areas and stuff. He was just filling up every day, he'd go around and he'd fill up these garbage cans with oranges for the children. It's an orange. It's still a perfectly good orange. Perfectly nutritious, vitamin C, the whole nine yards. But the Orange Marketing Board came down and said, if you do not cease and desist this activity, we will never buy another orange off you. What? We create enough food today to feed 40 billion people annually. But they're going to tell me today that there's a wheat shortage on Earth? The price of wheat's going up because there's a wheat shortage. Where did it all go? They probably dumped it in the ocean to save the price. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really nuts.
Once it spreads, it will not be able to be stopped. That hectare of land, that, you know, you started our conversation with the hectare of land. That excited me right off the bat.
Yeah.
And I knew you were right.
Yeah.
It resonates.
Yeah. And I think that I'm going to introduce it. A friend of mine wants me to be a member of the Action Party, and I don't know if I want to get into politics, but he's going to do it, and I told him that I would empower him with all the information I could possibly give him.
Yeah.
Though I may still do it. It's something that I have to think about more seriously because it's how much I want to put myself and my family through the whole political slaughterhouse. But at the same point, I am empowered with this information for a reason. And I can't, it would be a sin for me to die and not have been able to change the world based on what we know. Mm-hmm. Why else do we know it?
We are looking for a Canadian, Ron Paul.
Oh, there you go. I like the guy. Oh. His most sense that he made to me was kill the Fed and the IRS, which is a private subsidiary of the Fed.
And, you know, surprisingly, that is communicating to a lot of people. What's really interesting is seeing all these young people, they know that this is going on. There's a lot of people who know. And it's they want to do something about this.
And on that note, not that long ago, see, I've been talking about banks for 20-some-odd years, and one of my mentor in this is 91 years old now. He wrote a book called The Babylonian Woe. I just told the story so much and shared with so many people, but it didn't seem like it was really going anywhere. And this year, see, I've only moved back to Toronto on June 15th this year, this past summer. I was sitting in a cafe, well, the Grapefruit and Grapefruit Moon. I was sitting there, and the one girl is explaining to her friend how money works, how it comes to be created, how it's done. I was like, I've never heard anybody tell this. It's been happening more and more over the years, but not to this degree, this understanding. And right. I finally had to break into the conversation. I said, what are you talking about? That's about where money comes from. You know, banks just create money out of nothing, and blah, 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 blah. And I looked at her, and I said, oh, come on. Can't be that simple. No, it was, and she got really passionate. She was really telling me what I've been telling people for 20 years. And I just kept on playing with her. My friend Marie was laughing at me because she just sort of saw me just sort of stringing this girl on to the point where finally I said, I have to just level with you. I totally understand and love and respect what you're talking about. I just can't believe you're talking about it. You look so young. She says, well, all of my friends and all the young people today are talking about it because they all want to know where money comes from, and they're all asking their parents, and they're mad because their parents won't tell them or they don't know anything.
Everything that you just said, I feel like I stop myself from commenting because I don't want to stop the flow of what you're saying. But you must be picking up on our acknowledgement of what you're saying, even though we're silent.
Oh, totally. I totally am, because, you know, but the whole amazingness of being able to contact really anybody that you want, whether it's an animal. You know, I used to have times when I would talk to the birds that fly really up high, whether they were eagles or hawks, and I used to wonder if I could, because I had read something about shaman being able to go up into the consciousness of this bird and look through the bird's eyes and see what the bird sees. And so I used to experiment with these things, and I did this in my 20s, and I would look at a bird, and I would put my energy up to the bird and greet it and say, can I look through your eyes, you know? And I would be able to see an overview of what the bird was looking at, like as if I was up there. I could see things from above, and my consciousness could move and perceive like that. So because of the experiences I've had personally in my own life, a lot of the things in these Anastasia books started to resonate so much, because the more sort of non-traditional experiences a person has, and the more open someone is, and being an artist, you know, I'm open to the energies, I'm open to frequencies of growth, and I'm open to frequencies of sound and light and non-linear thinking and non-linear living, and you know, even up to the point of being an outcast in this society because of my own need to be me is bigger than needing to be with what's going on here. And as I get older, and as I have children that get older, they're not that old now, but I'm realizing that being with is really important. And as much as I've been outside of this society, I've created and co-created with people around me a family that's not a nuclear family, which is, I believe, a toxic waste dump. But a family of loving people who care about each other, who sometimes forget about each other because of the distances that we live, and whether we're, even if we're in the same city, but that care about each other and that care about similar, that hold ideals that are similar and hold them deeply. And what I'm feeling now as more of my own need in my life is to break down my barrier with judgment and my barriers of criticism, and allow myself this space of love around me and experience this beingness with everyone, and not let myself be engaged with the energy that I see that someone else might be engaged with. Someone who's very self-critical is engaged in a self-criticism energy. They're not engaged in loving themselves, right? So how am I going to have a loving relationship with this person who's engaged with criticizing themselves? I can take it as a hint and say, oh, you're just such a critical person, but really that person is just experiencing and allowing themselves to experience and inviting the experience of self-criticism. They're not taking any time to put their attention and their focus on self-love. And so you can really feel this. And there's people who are experimenting with this in all kinds of ways, you know.
It is an amazing discovery, amazing journey, and I think that's what we're going through right now.
Yeah, no, you totally hit it right on. And this, the Anastasia books really, really talk about that, you know, and I think that's why they're popular, very, very popular in many places. And if you look on websites, there is an entire Anastasia club range that is huge, like Deepak Chopra is in one of the clubs. So is Ram Dass, I think. Like all these sort of American gurus of the Enlightenment movement or the New Age movement, they're all part of some collective now. It's a website. I can't remember what it's called, but some collective somewhere around Mount Shasta where they're like looking to buy this large piece of land and do these hectares of family plots. So there's movement in, you know, America to have the same thing happen. And in Russia, I think the movements have been pretty profound because look at the Russians, you know, like even in my lifetime, and I'm 44, look what they've gone through.
Yeah.
You know, so this is like in the one lifetime of one person. This is what Vladimir talks about in the book. He says, look what we've been like spoon-fed. And we're still sitting there waiting to see who else is going to spoon-feed us, you know, like when are we going to start thinking for ourselves? And it's a pretty important comment to make in a society that really has just been like picked up and yanked and swept all different ways, you know. And you gotta know that in their cultures, like the earth cultures, like the Siberian culture and even the Mongolians who live close by, I mean, those are profound ancient cultures, and they're very earth-based cultures, like our, you know, native people, and they have an understanding of life, like in the native circle, you know, you've got the four directions and the meaningfulness of how everything connects to everything else. And it's all about life, and it's all about how the movement and flow of things go, you know. And so it's making sense of, it's a cosmology. Well, in a political system, there's no cosmology. So we're living in something that was programmed. And I heard that in the 40s, there was actually a guy who came up with the idea in the States. I can't remember his name, but he came up with the idea of, hey, well, we're not really focusing our society on something. Why don't we become consumers? Why don't we become the world's consumers? And there's actually a manifesto written that this guy wrote, what it would be like for all Americans to become the number one consumers of the world. It was astounding that somebody thought about what the American public should consider its manifesto. And it has come to be. When one person is acting, it's one thing. But then when one person merges with another person, those two people are not just two people. The field of two people together is exponentially more powerful than one. And then when you add a third person, that's, again, exponentially bigger. It's not just three individual people. Three individual people is one thing. But when you put three people who are together and united, that field is exponential. And I'm talking about energetically and consciously and with, you know, using your awareness. So if you have a meditation and you're meditating by yourself, well, certain kind of energy is happening, right? If you're meditating and there's two people, then there's a different energy and you can really feel it. You're in a room with 40 people meditating, you can feel it. You're in a room with 1,000 people meditating or a space somewhere, or you're tuned into 40,000 people or 2,000 people or 1,000,000 people all meditating or playing drums or dancing or singing all at the same time. then something is happening, and you can feel that something that's happening, even though you can't put your finger on it and you can't really talk about what it is, but you can energetically feel it. And if you're part of that group, and these now many things have happened over the past few years where people have, James Twyman has organized all kinds of events where people are doing things simultaneously. I remember during the Harmonic Convergence, the Harmonic Concordance, there were many people celebrating around the same time, focusing on the same types of things. Lots of people do it around moons, new moon, and full moon. Still in many cultures, those are deep celebrations. You know, where new moon, you figure out your focus for that month, and you open up to receiving, you know, that. Full moon, it's the completion of all that energy.
The eclipse of the moon that happened very recently, I guess it was around 2 weeks ago, and Jer and I got to experience it in a way that I've never experienced an eclipse of a moon before. All we had to do was walk out on our back balcony.
Oh, yeah.
And there it was. It became dimensional. The color, the orange, the red, the feeling that came off of it.
And the turquoise glow.
And the turquoise glow. After that happened, Jer and I both felt a bump, like, oh, everything's different again. Something's shifted here again. I've seen a number of eclipses, and it's like, yeah, well, okay, it's an eclipse, and, yeah, this recent one was exceptional.
I totally agree. I had the same experience. I didn't get to see it all the way through, but I was so tuned into it, and it was, for me, like it was an inside-out thing. Like, I felt like all the things that were hidden got turned inside out, and they were now exposed.
Exactly. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I went on the internet the next day, and I checked newspapers, and none of the information out there captured what we saw. The pictures were very dull. But at this particular moment that we were looking out, it was like Saturn had come from eons of time away and had moved right up to the forefront, and everything was exposed.
Wow.
And I did read that Saturn wasn't involved with that particular eclipse. Now, I think we saw it close up. It was surreal.
Yeah, it was really amazing. I have... can we just put on pause for a second?
We're sure. On pause.
Hey, where'd you find this place, man?
They said, come up to Petroglyphs. It'll be a great place. If anyone ever... Best place in the world.
But man, look down there. It opens up. It looks like a big cavern down there, man.
This looks like a bottle, man. If you pull back on it just like this...
What are you fooling around? Don't fool around with that shit, man.
Well, maybe it's like a beer tap or something like that. Anyway, these are great. Look at that.
Hey, don't play around with that stuff. Oh, now you said something more.
Uh-oh. I know. Oh, yeah, that sounds sort of like a
Leave it alone, man. It might be a bomb or something.
Well, I hope not.
Oh! Uh-oh. Now you did it. You blew up that whole
get
shelf
out of here?
There, man. Now, Igor's gone, right?
Yeah.
Didn't you hear him walking away, man? Anyways, Bob, these books are worth a lot, eh?
They must be. They contain all the knowledge and all that stuff. Look at it. I got one right here, The Maiden Goddess of Crete.
Well, do you think you can carry one or two books, man?
Well, they're big books.
Because I think we should grab a book each and run for it. This stuff might be worth something, man.
Okay.
What are you doing, you hoser?
Well, I'm climbing up on this ridge here. It looks like a good place to... Well, I don't know. Hey, it's a way out. Look at this. Well, I've never seen anything like it. You got to see it for yourself, Doug.
Yeah, I'm kind of expecting like...
Sort of like Star Trek or something.
Spock and Kirk to come down, eh?
It's... I think I... You know, what kind of beer do you... What kind of beer was I drinking?
What kind of beer were you? Uh-oh.
It must be the maiden in distress, eh? Oh, there she goes for a little swim. Hey, no, she's a mermaid. Doug, you got to see this. Hi there. How you doing? Yeah, my name's Bob, and this is Doug. And we're just here to, you know, hide our beer and stuff like that. But we didn't know that mermaids hung out here, you know. Maybe you got some, like, this is the place of secret knowledge. Like, you could tell us something, or... She didn't say anything, Doug.
That's because she's drowning, man.
No, she can't be drowning. Mermaids don't drown.
Oh, yeah, right. Cool.
She sure is beautiful.
Yeah, forget her and let's get out of here. How are we going to carry the books and the beer?
No, we're going to leave the beer here.
Have you got another case in the trunk?
Yeah.
Okay, cool, man. You hoser. Let's get out of here, man.
And one of the things I really found intriguing was peeing on the land.
The land.
In the physical.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that I would do. It was interesting that when Jared brought it up to me, I went, yeah, well, yeah, that's what I do. If I'm living somewhere, I go and pee on it all over the place. I'm going to pee on this land.
I didn't talk about that the other night.
Well, you didn't. That's why I want you to talk about it now.
I'll have to deal with that when it comes. Because it's still, I come from a culture where that's supposed to be dirty.
How do I put this? That you have traveled with Anastasia in the dream time, and you're doing your own journey, and you're traveling to Peru or whatever, and connecting probably with this very same energy. That's when you find the need to actually place your mark in that, on that land.
About my traveling, I went around the world about 6 times during the 80s, and I actually found myself at or close to sacred sites around the planet, and I always felt compelled to urinating near those places, mostly just that I could probably just to relieve myself, but there's also this other side of me that thought that if I left something behind, I could always visit it. It's sort of like placing our DNA in certain locations, and the further we spread ourselves out, the further we can actually sit cross-legged and actually visit these places. I feel for myself, I've been able to get to these obscure corners of the world, and by touching them, smelling them, seeing them, can actually recreate that sense within myself and revisit it whenever I like. Only in my mind through reading, in my imagination through reading the Ringing Cedars series, have been able to go to the next stage, which suggests that we have the potential to really go to the other side of the galaxy or wherever. And as a result, I sort of imagine where I can probably, you know, just for thinking of Pluto, go there and be back already. Because according to this woman, this is what our brain can do. It's easy to teleport ourselves. No, it's easy to travel by thought. A little bit more difficult, but not that much more difficult to travel in the physical. She suggests that to travel in the physical takes a little bit more responsibility because we have to look forward, see where we're going to land, see who we're going to affect, see the climate that we're going to arrive at. You know, if you sort of imagine what it might be like to see the Titanic today, and you just went there, well, materializing beside the Titanic right now would probably have pretty devastating effects on yourself. The pressure in the water and, you know, it's just... So these are our responsibilities that we have to also seriously process. The main themes throughout Anastasia's suggestions is that we have to speed up our thinking processes and really connect to the responsibility that we have to ourselves, to this process. One example she gives, she takes Vladimir to another planet, and this planet has these big machines that are sucking natural resources out of the ground, and right on the spot, they're taking the natural resources and they're manufacturing flying saucers or flying discs. And he thinks, wow, this is really cool. And she explains that these things are doing this through a telepathic connection to their masters. And he says, wow, this is really cool. I'd like to make something. And she says, well, all you have to do is stand in front of one of these, and it'll lock into you, and it will manufacture whatever or manifest whatever you're thinking about. So he says, let me try it. And so he lines up in front of one of these big machines, and the radio wave taps into his brain, and he sort of imagines one of his favorite Russian cars from the 60s. Chug, 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 plunk, pops this car out. He walks up to the car, and it looks like the car, and he walks around to the other side of the car, and of course there's no door on the other side of the car, and he looks inside the car, and there's no back seat, and he lifts up the hood, and there's no motor, and he sort of complains to Anastasia, well, what kind of a piece of junk is this? I mean, it didn't make a very good car. And she said, well, you can't blame the manufacturer. It's the designer that made the mistake. You didn't see it through. You have to take responsibility for seeing all aspects and all the effects of your involvement in everything. And only through learning how to think and think quicker can we actually learn to manifest and learn how to be responsible for the effects. I'm watching children play today, and this one kid, he's playing rough with a smaller kid, and he throws him on the floor, and the little kid hurts himself. And he comes up, he says, well, I didn't mind you doing that, but you didn't have to drop me on the concrete floor. I hurt my head. And, oh, I didn't do it, blah, blah, blah. And I looked at him. I said, why are you lying? You just threw him on the floor. Well, and he starts making up all these excuses. And I said, you know, my friend, you have to take responsibility for yourself here. You just threw him on the floor. Well, I didn't mean it. It was an accident. You know, think it through. You're playing rough. It's a concrete floor. What do you think can happen? But everybody's in such denial these days, they're so afraid to get in trouble, that our first reaction is to lie. We all have to take responsibility for the mess that we're in here. Even the overlords, you know, I mean, they must not be able to sleep at night without large amounts of sleeping drugs for fear that if the masses ever woke up and realized that these massive trust funds that are held by huge foundations that could liberate the planet in a minute, if these guys would loosen up the reins and not have a war, because nobody wants to be at war with America, but that America, these guys, not even Americans, because Americans don't want to go to war either, but these guys are just, they're irresponsible. They're irresponsible psychopaths, technically. And they think that that's how they control and that's how the game's played. And they must be terrified, because I feel the fear in society, and it's not my fear. But all of us are empathic enough to think, is that my fear? No, it's not my fear. It's their fear that we're waking up. And they're terrified that maybe someone's going to come after them to make them pay, because they've trained this whole society on how to focus on the troublemaker. And these guys have technically for a long time been invisible, but they're no longer invisible. They're standing there in plain sight now. I mean, there's not, you say names like Rockefeller, everybody knows who you're talking about now. And that's even after Rockefeller took over the educational system in the 1900s, took over the teachers' colleges, so he could teach teachers to stop teaching about the Rockefellers. It didn't work. Or it did for a while. but the news is out again. So if they just stopped spending money on war for a week, I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars available for every man, woman, and child immediately. There's no shortage of money. That's why I get mad at politicians when they say, oh, budgets, and we can't do this and we can't do that because there's no money. They're either ignorant or they're lying. And I'll forgive them if they're just ignorant because we can teach them. The fact is, the planet is a gazillionaire. It's a trust fund for prosperity. So why is it half a dozen families think that they should keep it all for themselves and watch all this suffering going on? I don't believe the planet's even overpopulated, as so many people say. And I only say that because you go an hour in any direction away from any city and it's just open fields. You know, I would agree that probably on a meat-based diet, where we're feeding all the grains to the cows, where if we actually reprocess the grains back to ourselves, we could probably have lots to eat. Aside from the fact, as I think I said the other day, the planet's currently producing enough food to feed about 40 billion people a year. So, feed them. Is it just a simple administration problem? We can send rockets and spaceships to Mars, but we can't figure out how to get a truckload of grain over to somebody else? I remember a comedian years ago, Sam Kinison. He was a pretty funny guy. He said he was a minister, a Baptist minister, who discovered comedy. And he went off on this one tangent where he said, I don't think you should send food to the starving people in Africa. I don't think you should send them money. I really think you should just send them luggage. He said, luggage? He said, yeah, send them luggage. Tell them to pack their things. He says, we have deserts in America, too. We just don't live in them. So pack your things. We're going to take you to where the food is. Right? There's no shortage of food here. And there's no shortage of space. As long as we keep buying into these ideas, we're being irresponsible to other human beings. You know, we're all stuck in these little anthills. I mean, I'm getting more and more convinced as each day goes by that cities are completely anti-human. There's nothing, makes no sense here. We can't make enough food here to live, so what are we doing here? And if there's any truth to the notion that with the whole peak oil story, that the peak oil story is running so they can suggest someday that we don't have enough gasoline to get food into the city. 72 hours worth of food at any given moment in any city. On-time delivery systems. So, what happens if they say there's no gas, no pipeline, they can't run the oil, they can't run the truck to bring the food? Food riots. Why did I just read in one of the local newspapers the other day, one of the street newspapers, that said that on February 14th, the Harper government signed a deal with the American government saying that they bonded both our militaries together in a North American army, they called it, that Canadian soldiers can go to America and American soldiers can come to Canada. And the Americans have been given access, permission to shoot Canadians during unrest, civil unrest, and Canadians can go to America and shoot Americans during civil unrest. And then they manifest or manufacture a food shortage, and with 4 million people in Toronto all trying to eat the same potato, I think there's going to be a fight. Mm. I think that every single person that hears your show from now on, when they meet a politician and they're shaking their hand and they look them in the eyes and they grip their hand very firmly, they look them in the eyes and they say, at the end of the day, who do you work for, sir? And without hesitation, if that politician doesn't say, for you, then they should not not be voted for. And that's the new wave. People keep telling me I should write a book. And I say, well, my problem is as soon as I put the pen to the paper, I forget what I want to say.
I'm like
so,
that, too.
So what I really specialize in doing is something like what we just had, is have a casual conversation with somebody, and we can broach any subject, go all over the place, and then have some, you know, somebody else type it all up. And then I can re-edit all that. And that would be the best way for me to ever get a book made, would be to record a bunch of conversations or speeches or mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff, and then you know, rework where it got off the wires a little bit, mm-hmm. you know, because there's stuff that you just have to fine-tune. But
And how you recapped it so beautifully for people like me that wouldn't have a clue without a calculator. So
uh-huh.
Thank you for simplifying that.
Well, that's what I've been doing, because for 20 years, 25 years, I've struggled with this story, because a whole combination of terrible things have happened, i.e., I tell this story, and first of all, it's so convoluted and so complicated in certain ways that, in fact, I witnessed people, their eyes, one would point up and one would point down, and then they would go off in different directions in 6 minutes or less.
Hmm.
And from that point on, if you saw me walking down the street, you would go to the other side of the road. I've had girlfriends in the past who said, Dwayne, we're invited to a party, but you can't talk about banks tonight. Well, this is my passion. I really like talking about this stuff. So over the 25 years, I've actually learned, I call it banking for dummies. You know, it's kind of just like, well, really, what irks you that they can produce money out of nothing? And when bankers are talking about this $7 billion profit that they make every year, did you know that more than half of that comes just from this one investment that they make with money with nothing, where they buy Canadian treasury bills? They buy treasury bills with this fictitious money, and they're getting paid $3.5 billion a year for that. And that's something I'd love to get out there. It's this $3.5 billion that they're getting for nothing. If you and I made an investment like that, it would be totally illegal. Because I used to think that I could heal people. And I know I can. I know we all have the ability, when we give somebody a hug, we make the other person feel better. Thus, we've taken away some of their hurt. And it's in that hurt that the negative energy exists that is causing the dis-ease and causing pain towards these organs that are shutting down. When we all take responsibility for ourselves and we quicken our minds so we can comprehend better, more larger, let's say, larger paradigms around us. Is it possible that we can? It is possible. What am I? I'm not going to say, is it possible? It is possible that we can cure the whole planet with one thought. But there's so much, we're being bombarded with so many thought patterns right now, especially in the city with advertising and microwaves. And is it possible to actually step outside of that paradigm for a moment, to clear the mind, calm down, and see what it is that, what truth it is you really want to walk? How do you really want to live? Because if you don't want to live the way you're living now, then just don't. As you said, Dennis, a few minutes ago, we make a choice every morning.
Dennis and I would like to extend our gratitude to both Dwayne and Darinka
for being guests on our show this evening. You know what I love about you guys? You're storytellers. And you tell those stories in such an eloquent way that it remains in your heart. And it's there for you to take and to study and to think of all the possibilities you can do with what they have brought to you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And also our thanks to the boys at BBS Radio. Without you, this would not be possible. God bless and be light. Good night. Dream path to Starship Control. Over and out.
I stood in the air.